So I've been talking about the 12 and working through the 12 apostles. And so I wanted to talk about Thomas. Thomas, who is known as Didymus, Didymus meaning, like Thomas, the twin. And one of the great questions about Thomas down through the ages is, whose twin? If he's the twin, who's his brother, who's his sister, who's his sibling? The name Judas is also associated with Thomas, and so it's possible that it is correct to call him Thomas Judas Didymus. In any case, these two images here on the left, this is the martyrdom of Thomas by Peter Paul Rubens, done between 1636 and 1638, Thomas being speared. And on the right is the St. Thomas Cathedral Basilica in Madras, India. So first off, the issue of the twin thing. It's important to keep in mind that in the ancient world, twins were regarded as a bad omen, as a bad sign. Women who gave birth to twins had really high levels of mortality in the ancient world. And so when a woman gave birth to a child and it turned out there was a second child in her womb also, this was generally regarded as a bad sign. And the second child was regarded as a double or a shadow of the first child. So the second child was usually viewed with some suspicion that there was something not quite right with the second child. The twin was regarded as a shadow, as an interloper, as a suspicious character, as a weaker reflection of the firstborn. And so when you think about the story of Jacob and Esau, it puts that story in a really different light, because Jacob is the secondborn. Jacob is the shadow. And it's from Jacob that we get the 12 tribes of Israel. And it's from Jacob that we get the line that gives us Jesus. And so that is countercultural in a significant way, in a way that we tend to pass right over. The second twin usurped the first. You know, in our day, okay, that's sibling rivalry. But in the first century, the idea that the second of the two became the dominant one is considered to be pretty weird. Not quite normal. The second twin is always viewed as the lesser. And so the question with respect to Thomas the twin, Didymus, down through the ages, from very early on, was, it always says that he's the twin. Who is he the twin of? And if we call him the twin, doesn't that mean he's the second? That he's the shadow? So fairly early on, and this is largely part of the Gnostic tradition, the idea that there is secret knowledge. The Gnostics were looking for, who is it that would have the secret knowledge that Jesus didn't say publicly? And they hit on a kind of a semi-brilliant idea, which was Jesus's twin, his shadow, would be the guy who knew the stuff. And so the Thomas was the twin of Jesus. He was the secret twin brother of Jesus. He was the shadow of Jesus. And therefore, Jesus told him stuff that he didn't tell anybody else. And so what do we have with Thomas? We have In the first three centuries, we have the Gospel of Thomas, the Infancy Gospel of Thomas, the Acts of Thomas, the Book of Thomas the Contender. We have four major works, all of them heretical and ahistorical, that are about Thomas, because there was a fascination with Thomas in the first century, in the second century, about who is Thomas and what does it mean that he's the twin? And maybe he's the twin of Jesus, and that means he knows stuff. And so this is a thing that was running around rumors in the early church. You know, the sort of rumors that people, you know, pursue on the internet today. It was that same sort of thing. I saw it on Facebook. It must be true. Okay? This was that same kind of a thing. So Gnostic writers for three or four centuries found Thomas super useful because they could say, well, Thomas is the twin. He's the twin of Jesus. Of course he knew the secrets. If I can attribute this to Thomas, that Thomas said it, then we know, right? So that is almost, well, that is untrue. Okay, all that's made up, right? Entirely so. We don't know who Thomas was the twin of. Okay, and because we don't know, it's likely that whoever he was the twin of was not a believer. Because whoever he was the twin of has no place in this story. But he was known as the twin because he was a twin, whether he was the older or the younger. And that was regarded as a very noteworthy characteristic at the time. It was regarded as a noteworthy thing. But it is worth knowing that there were early rumors, and these persisted for some centuries and up into the Middle Ages, that Thomas was the twin of Jesus. What do you remember about Thomas? He doubted, right? That's what we remember about Thomas. So all the stuff about Thomas that we have is in John's Gospel. John chapter 11. The disciples are talking about going up to Jerusalem, and they're talking about it's dangerous, and they're going to try to kill him. And what does Thomas say? Let's go and die with him. That's what doubting Thomas says in John chapter 11. In John chapter 14, Jesus is talking to them about the future. And he says, I'm going to go to a place where you can't be, but I will return. And Thomas is the guy who says, if you are not going to tell us where you're going, how can we know the way? How do we know where to go? So Thomas plays the part of kind of the realist. And of course, in John chapter 20, Thomas is the guy that says, unless I can put my fingers in his side, I'm not going to believe. And so we have a figure of speech that persists in our culture today, that anybody who says, I won't believe it until I see it, we call them a doubting Thomas, right? That's a thing that we say today. But take a moment with me and look at the passage in John chapter 20. There's something in this passage that I think I've been missing for a long time, and you may be missing it too. John chapter 20, beginning at verse 24. Now Thomas, one of the 12, called the twin, was not with them when Jesus came. So the other disciples told him, we have seen the Lord. But he said to them, unless I see his hands, the mark of the nails, and place my finger in the mark of the nails, and place my hand into his side, I will never believe. That's the Thomas quote that he has been remembered for two millennia. 8 days later, his disciples were inside again, and Thomas was with them. Although the doors were locked, Jesus came and stood among them and said, peace be with you. Then he said to Thomas, put your finger here and see my hands, and put your hand and place it in my side. Do not disbelieve, but believe. Thomas answered him, my Lord and my God. Who prior to that moment, had acknowledged verbally and in front of other people that they believed that Jesus was God incarnate. God come in the flesh. Who would acknowledge that before that moment? Peter. And that's the whole list. Thomas acknowledges something here and says something here that puts him ahead of most of the rest of the people involved in the early church. Because in making this confession, my Lord and my God, he is saying, I don't just believe that you are the Messiah. I believe that you are God incarnate. Now, theologically, that's a significant additional step. And it's a step that the church over the first century and beyond spent time wrestling with. And into the second century, this thing that Thomas said became a big part of the theological conversation of the early church. About who is Jesus? What does this mean? What do we really believe? Do you really believe that Jesus is God incarnate, God in the flesh? Thomas confessed to that here in John chapter 20. But do you remember that? Do you think about that when you think about Thomas? I don't think about that when I think about Thomas. I think about the previous quote when I think about Thomas. But Thomas makes a very, very important statement here, which is a statement that becomes pivotal in discussions about Jesus, who he is, his divinity, what it means to believe in a triune God over the next two centuries. My Lord and my God. So I want to point out to you that Thomas is not being treated very fairly in my mind. Historically, because I tend to think of him as doubting Thomas. And he did. But once he understood, he made a mental connection that almost nobody else had understood yet. And just because they believed that Jesus was alive again does not mean that they really understood anything about what that meant. Thomas immediately understands something about what this means that is probable that most of the rest did not get at that point. And so, this is one of the most important confessions in the Bible. My Lord and my God. And it's made by the man that we think of as the doubter. So, you read, there's a significant passage in Luke chapter 24, verses 36 to 49, which is about what were the 12 thinking at this time. And it's Luke makes it pretty clear that they really didn't get it at that point. And it's an interesting contrast to what Thomas says here in John chapter 20, which is a sort of a parallel passage. But Thomas acknowledges the divinity of Jesus, that he is God incarnate. That is a very, very important important statement, and it's a thing that the early church spent the next more than a century wrestling with, trying to understand. Trying to come to a point of believing this, first of all. Many early Christians did not believe what Thomas believes right here. Because they came out of a Jewish tradition that said there is one God. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. And so the idea that Jesus was God incarnate didn't work with that basic scheme. It was a long time before people in the church came to truly understand that God could be one and yet three. That's something that conceptually it took a couple of centuries for the church to really start to grasp. So, but Thomas gets a hold of that right here in John chapter 20. And so I would encourage you to give Thomas a little bit of credit. And I would also encourage you to keep in mind that there are some things about Thomas that he's got to be connected to John somehow, because all the stuff about Thomas is in John's gospel. And so they were friends or something. But there's a reason why John thinks that Thomas's story is particularly important, and none of the other three gospel writers pay any attention to Thomas. Let's think a little bit about some traditions to give with Thomas, and there's a very unusual amount of early writing about Thomas, which is because of this twin thing and the Gnostic thing and the idea that he is the perfect guy to use as a vessel for the secrets. So the Gospel of Thomas comes from early in the second century, sometime before AD 150, maybe 20 or 30 years earlier than that. It's a Gnostic gospel. It's a gospel that was written by somebody who wanted to sell the idea that, you can go to the church, you can talk to the Christians, but they're not telling you the whole story. Okay? So the Gnostics were about the idea that there are secrets that only the initiated, only the special people get to know. And the Gnostics pioneered this idea that we should have a public statement about what we believe, but if you join us, we'll tell you some secrets about what we really believe, and if you stick around, we'll tell you more secrets. This should ring some bells with you, by the way, in the 21st century. It's the way the Mormon church works. Okay. Mormons do this. Scientology does this. Almost all, you know.
Scientology, you pay for it.
Yeah, in Scientology, you pay for each step, right? So.
State of Rhode Island does very well.
Yeah. Yeah, so sometimes government does it, yes. But any organization that has secrets and you have to progressively work up the chain to get the secrets.
Yeah.
You know, those kinds of things come out of this larger Gnostic tradition, which is a big thing that's happening particularly in the second century. But the idea that there is secret knowledge and you've got to be part of us. And so, we're 2 Timothy 2:2 guys, and the things that you have heard from me in the presence of many witnesses, the things we believe, we say in front of everybody. If you join the church, do you get a little thing that says, this is what we really believe? This is who we really are? No. We tell you up front, this is who we are, this is what we believe, and we post it on our website. That's the way Christianity works, okay? But the Gnostic tradition is the idea that now there's secrets, which appeals to a lot of people. So the Gospel of Thomas from early in the second century is not really a gospel in the sense that we think of the four gospels. It's a collection of sayings. There's no narrative in the Gospel of Thomas. There's no storyline. There's no beginning. There's no end. It's a collection of sayings that are attributed to Jesus. And some of them are sayings of Jesus. Whoever wrote the Gospel of Thomas lifted a bunch of quotes from one of the four Gospels that we have in the Bible. So there's a bunch of things that Jesus really did say in the Gospel of Thomas, which are interspersed with a whole bunch of stuff that he didn't say, some of which is wackadoodle weird. Okay? I mean, just crazy stuff, okay? The Gospel of Thomas says, among other things, if you are a true believer who really understands yourself, you can go around naked because you are fully revealed to people, so you don't need to wear clothing because you're already fully revealed and your integrity holds together and there's no reason to wear clothes. That's in the Gospel of Thomas. I don't think almost anybody even in the Gnostics did that, but anyway, but it's there are hidden words of Jesus that are included in the Gospel of Thomas that were allegedly written down by Thomas because Jesus shared the real secret stuff with him. Because, you know, they were secretly brothers. So it's the stuff that was not shared with the whole church. Anyway, this, Eusebius writes about how this is heretical and totally fictional. At the end of the 3rd century when he's writing, nobody really believes the Gospel of Thomas except for really serious conspiracy theorists. Even in the 2nd century, people pointed that, said, no, that's not Christianity. That's something entirely different. So, but it's Jesus and stuff. And you still see that in cult stuff today, right? We got Jesus and.
Do you know who wrote it and when it was written?
Nobody knows who wrote the Gospel of Thomas, but it dates to earlier than 150 AD. So not into the 1st century, but sometime early in the 2nd century. But it's a deliberately anonymous author because the author claims to be Thomas. Or claims to have gotten their information from Thomas somehow. So there's also a thing that was written before about AD 180, and we know it's before AD 180 because it was condemned as heretical in AD 180, but we don't know how much earlier than that it was written or by whom. But it's known today as the Infancy Gospel of Thomas. And the Infancy Gospel of Thomas is a whole collection of stories of the early life of Jesus. Jesus from age 5 to age 12, for the most part. It's got stories like the little boy Jesus, there's clay, and he molds the clay into birds and then brings them to life. So it's a Jesus, a child Jesus, who uses his power for his own pleasure and amusement. That's what the Infancy Gospel of Thomas is about. So it's about the idea that Jesus kind of grew into maturity, and along the way he had some fun with the fact that he could do stuff.
Isn't that in the Quran too?
There is some stuff in the Quran that probably comes from it. Muhammad's creation of the Quran is a tremendously interesting story, and a lot of stuff is not very well known, but it seems very clear that Muhammad used many other sources and pulled them in, including Old Testament stuff at least. So some of the stuff that comes out of the Infancy Gospel of Thomas ends up in the Quran. There's a thing called the Acts of Thomas, which was written sometime between about AD 180 and maybe 230, the end of the 2nd century there, beginning of the 3rd century. It has a martyrdom story about Thomas, where Thomas goes to some faraway place, converts the wife and son of the king, and then the king has him speared to death on a small hill where he was known to preach. This was probably written in Edessa, the city northeast of Antioch, northeast from Jerusalem, quite a ways northeast from Damascus. But Edessa was a very important city in the life of the church from the middle of the 1st century or late 1st century for the next several centuries. And a lot of stuff passed through there. It actually aligns with traditions from India. And the Acts of Thomas is one of the places that says that Thomas was an identical twin of Jesus. And the Acts of Thomas says the reason that Judas Iscariot kissed Jesus on that night in the Garden of Gethsemane is that Thomas was his identical twin. And only Judas knew how to tell the difference between the two. All right, that's not true either. But anyway, makes for kind of sort of interesting fictional reading. There's also a thing called Thomas the Contender, which is an incomplete manuscript, and it wasn't titled that, but it has a line where it says, I, Thomas, am contending. And so it's become known as Thomas the Contender. It was found among the Nag Hammadi papers, which are from the early 4th century. That was a Gnostic community in Egypt where, like the Dead Sea Scrolls, they found writings on scrolls that were preserved in clay pots and buried in the desert and then not found for more than 1,000 years. Thomas the Contender, an incomplete text. Thomas is sort of the earthly and lesser form or partner of Jesus. And in Thomas the Contender, Thomas and Jesus are engaged in a very metaphorical and symbolic dialogue about the meaning of life, which is so obscure that it may be about something else entirely. It's really difficult to say. But so I say all that to say that Thomas had a grip on the thinking of people in the 1st, 2nd, 3rd century that is unlike most of the other members of the 12. And it's partly because people felt the need to write things into Thomas's story. So what really is in Thomas's story? Well, Eusebius says that Thomas and Bartholomew were sent to Parthia in India. It is believed and reasonably well attested that Thomas reached Kerala on the Malabar coast of southwest India in about AD 52, about 2 years, maybe 3 years after the council at Jerusalem. And if he did so, that was along a regular Roman trading route. There was regular sea traffic, there was regular land traffic, and so he could have traveled overland, which would have taken him through the Parthian Empire. Parthia was a regional empire that had taken over much of the space that had previously been Persia, and then had been the Eastern Kingdom founded by Alexander the Great. The Parthians and the Romans butted heads repeatedly and were at war often, but it was not that hard to travel through the Parthian Empire overland. That's current Iraq, Iran, Afghanistan, a little bit of Pakistan. And Edessa is a useful jumping off point for making that journey. You go to Edessa, to Babylon, and then travel east and south from there. Thomas is believed to have preached to Jews in merchant colonies, to local families, established churches in 7 or 8 communities, converted some prominent local families, and spent from about AD 52 to AD 59 in the southwest coast of India. In around AD 59, he is believed to have moved across the tip of the Indian Peninsula to the southeast coast, to what is now Chennai, Madras, and have begun a ministry there. There is some tradition which dates to at least the 8th century and maybe earlier, that at some point while Thomas was in India, he got on with some traders and went to China. There's a tradition in the church in Beijing that the church in Beijing, China, was founded by the Apostle Thomas in the 50s. There is also a tradition from, and there is a song that has been sung in the Indian church for centuries and centuries. It goes way, way back, that actually dates his trip to China to 49 AD. Which would mean that he wasn't at the Jerusalem Council to debate the issues that Paul brought about, do you have to be a Jew before you can be a Christian? Because he was in China. All right. So that's a stretch, certainly a stretch. There is also later traditions that say Thomas traveled with some Jewish merchants from India and went to Indonesia and shared the gospel there. In any case, the Church of Assyria which still exists, considers Thomas its founding bishop. You know, just like the Roman Catholic Church considers Peter to be its founding bishop, the Church of Assyria sees Thomas as the founding bishop. And he is considered to be the founding bishop of churches in Assyria and in southern India, and the church at Beijing claims Thomas as well. He's believed to have died in about AD 72. The Indian church puts the date as December 21st. Jerome, writing several centuries later in Rome, in the Syrian church, say July 3rd. But he died near Madras on the southeast coast of India. And this cathedral is built near that spot in honor of Thomas. Tradition has that he was lanced in the back, perhaps while preaching on a favorite hilltop. That hilltop is now known as St. Thomas Mount and is the site of a small church, which was built by Portuguese traders in the 16th century. There is traditions associated with St. Thomas Mount that say that after Thomas was dead, he still managed to convert the king to the faith by one means or another, and there's a variety of stories that go with that. Some of Thomas's relics are held at the St. Thomas Cathedral Basilica in Madras here in the picture. The earliest known church on that particular spot dates to the 10th century, but it's possible that there was a church there before that. This church, the current church, was finished in 1896. There is a church in a place called Ortona in Italy, which claims to have most of the body of Thomas, which it claims were moved there in 1258 from Edessa. That church was subsequently sacked by Turkish raiders and the tomb was rifled, so it's a little unclear what's left in the tomb. There is a church in Rome that has an ancient index finger, the bones from an ancient index finger, and they say that it's Thomas's finger that touched Jesus' side. You can go see it. You can go see it if you want. It's there. Anyway, the provenance on that is a little shaky. No, it's a lot shaky. Anyway, that's there. And those stories are based around the idea that at some point, a king in southern India, around 232 or so AD, sent the bones of Thomas to Edessa. And when they arrived in Edessa, they arrived and were interred in a great ceremony on the 3rd of July. And this is why the Syrian church and Jerome associate the 3rd of July with the death of Thomas. And the Indian church says, no, the 21st of December. Our friend Egeria, the traveling woman in the 380s, reports that when she went to Edessa, she saw the entire body of Thomas in a church there that had been built to honor him. So if there truly are relics here at the church in Madras, it's not clear how they got back there, because it seems likely that Thomas's body or his remains was removed from India fairly early on. Eusebius records that in the late 2nd century, a guy named Pantaenus, who was from Sicily, and he was a teacher of Clement of Alexandria, a smart guy, capable guy, most of whose writings have not survived, but that Pantaenus went as a missionary on a long journey in the late 2nd century. He died around AD 200, and he visited India. And he thought in going to India that he would be the first missionary to take the gospel to India. And then when he reached southern India, he was shocked to find that there were a whole string of churches there, and that those churches were using a copy of the Gospel of Matthew, that they had Matthew's Gospel. And that was the scripture that they were reading. And the Pantaneus took the time to make a copy of the Matthew's gospel that he saw in India and brought it back to Alexandria with him, so they could check the text. Hippolytus taught that Thomas preached in an ark through what is now Iran and Pakistan, and then went to India and was martyred by a spear thrust. In the mid-second century, a local king at Kerala, where Thomas is believed to have arrived in 52 AD, was a Christian. And the cross was a symbol that was used by the church in India at least a century before it was used by the church in the West. The early church in the West did not use the cross as a symbol. It used a fish. Ichthus. But the church in India used the cross from at least the second century and probably the first. So somebody introduced that idea very, very early on. In AD 522, somebody wrote a thing called the Christian Typography, which is an attempt to account for all the churches and all the Christians in all of the world, and it reports the existence of a whole string of churches in southern India. And the churches of southern India think that they were founded by Thomas. They believe that their roots go back to that. Vasco da Gama in 1503, the explorer, on visiting southern India, met groups of Christians, he says, who were on a pilgrimage to the tomb of the Apostle Thomas. He was surprised to find this. In 1952, the church in Syria celebrated the 1900th anniversary of the coming of Thomas to Syria with the gospel. Anyway, Thomas in India is one of the best attested of all the apostolic travels, all the apostolic missionaries' work. And Thomas's stuff is probably better attested than anybody except for Peter and John. And if you're thinking about what to call Thomas, I would suggest that instead of calling him Doubting Thomas, you might call him the Apostle to India. That might be more appropriate. He is a founder of churches and maybe a converter of kings. Thomas.